Om Mangalam Guru Devaya Devi Matriksha Mangalam Mangalam Bhakta Brindevyo Sarva Lokaya Mangalam Om Stapakaya Chidharmasya Sarva Dharma Sarupini Avatara Varishtaya Ramakrishnaya Te Namaha Om Jananim Sharadam Devim Ramakrishnam Jagat Gurum Parapadmeta Yostritva Pranamami Muhur Muhur Om Sarashiva Samarambam Shankaracharya Madhyamam Ashmar Achara Prayantam Vande Gurum Paramparam. So we're continuing our study of the Narada Bhakti Sutra. I think our last class was 2 weeks ago. Last week we had our festival, so we skipped a week. And the week before, we were on a very beautiful section, and after giving some preliminary definitions of a bhakti, as parama prema, supreme love, and some of its glorifications of bhakti as being sufficient unto itself for God realization, the highest path, all those beautiful verses. Then it began to give some clues of how to walk that path of devotion as the bhakti as taught by Narada Muni. And so we only did a few verses last week, and we'll only do even fewer, I think 3 or 4 verses tonight. I'll read last week's verses so we can catch up. Tasya sadanani gayantya archara acharyaha. The great teachers, those great acharyas, they sing of the way to attain it, the way to attain devotion. Right? Tattu visaya tyagat, sangat tyagat cha. It is by renouncing objects and of enjoyment and renouncing attachment. So it starts out with a negative definition, right? How do you attain devotion? By renouncing all objects of attachment, both the objects of enjoyment and objects of and attachment to those objects. And so the path of devotion is considered the simplest of the path because of its positive nature, right? You simply love God, right? But here it starts with a seemingly negative statement. How do you love God? Oh, by becoming detached from the things of the world, right? But so this is, it's tricky because it's not exactly, because I know people who are detached from the things in the world. They don't have much love for God. That's not a guaranteed state, right? But it's where you put your value in, that's what you're going to run after. If you find your satisfaction in the self, satisfaction in God, the normal external items in the world do not attract the mind, right? And we'll find in the verses we'll get to tonight, the importance of company is shown, that the type of company we keep awakens different desires. Right, and so the desires, the external desires for external objects and attachment for those external objects, right, is a sign. When you're desiring something, it means you have some lack, and if you have some lack, it means you haven't found what you're looking for. You're not satisfied, right? So this is the nature of desire and attachment. So it starts with this negative definition, but quickly switches to a positive injunction by hearing. Lokepi Bhagavad Guna Shravanam Kirtanat. By hearing, Shravanam, and Kirtana, by chanting. Right? The Bhagavad Guna, the qualities of God, Bhagavan's qualities, his names, her names, his names, forms, qualities, pastimes, teachings, like this. So by singing, by listening to this, and by singing about it, that's the quickest way, it says, or a quick way to attain, to awaken devotion. So this is the positive side. And if you're engaged in remembering this divine remembrance of singing and hearing about the qualities of God, then naturally the attraction to external things become less. And this is a trick, because we hear in the scriptures and by all the religions of the world, they say that God dwells within, right? God, the self of all, self of the self. God's, if you find, my Guruji used to tell me, if you don't find God within your own self, you won't find him anywhere, right? He may be everywhere, but if you don't find him within, you're not going to find him anywhere. Right, so that's but our minds aren't habituated to look inward. We don't even know what that means. Those look within. What does that mean? Yeah, I don't even know how to look within. You know, so we self-inquire to so many methods, but it's not clear what does it mean to find God within. Right, The mind, why is that? Because the mind is an instrument of perception, and the mind uses another set of instruments called the senses, right? And the senses by nature bring information from the external, that's what they're for. They bring information from the external world. And so, and by habit, right, the mind constantly is going out with the senses, right? That's what the senses are for. Swami Chidananda, a very great saint, one of the main disciples of Swami Shivananda of Rishikesh, beautiful, and one satsang he gave, he was describing like that the Creator made the senses for the purpose of bringing information from the external world that we need for it to live. And he had to put some pleasure in those senses. Otherwise, there's no reason to use them. Right? We wouldn't look if looking was not pleasant. We wouldn't taste if tasting was not pleasant. But looking and hearing and tasting and touching are necessary for life, for our embodied life, right? So they had to be pleasure, right? So it's the nature of the mind. Otherwise, the mind wouldn't go out, wouldn't use those tools, right? And it was necessary to use those tools. But that's the danger. Because of the pleasure, we became a little bit addicted, right? I'm addicted to pieces of chocolate, right? There's a little hit of a pleasure, and then next you come by another piece, and then every time I can't walk by the counter without throwing a piece of chocolate to my mouth, right? That's a small little thing, right? But you can see how, and so out of habit, pretty soon that which is meant to be a tool, the senses, in order to perceive the external world, which is useful, becomes a master. We lose our freedom. Rather than using the tools, we become dependent upon them. And so much so, of course, the senses take control of our lives, and we run around chasing after different experiences without any control. Actually, there's a beautiful verse, there's a verse in the Gita and a corresponding verse in the Upanishads that describe the body is like a chariot, right? And the mind, the soul is the passenger on this chariot, and the mind is the charioteer, and the intellect and the senses are the five senses of the five horses, right? Pulling. So, and you can see the mind and the intellect is supposed to be controlling those horses to go to take the soul where it needs to go. But what happens? The horses are all untrained. Imagine putting five untrained horses to a chariot, and send the back of the chariot, right? So they're running in five different directions, without any control. And the reins are tangled, right? And then it goes very poetic. It says then to extend the metaphor, says the charioteer is also drunk. On top of that, he doesn't know what he's doing and he's lost, right? So you imagine the condition soldiers in horror. Being pushed his way and that way, right? Thinking that's freedom, right? You know, it's like rather than the senses under control, right? Taking the soul, the embodied soul, to what it needs to do in this world, right? That's why a little bit that negative, it starts with a little bit of control of the senses, control of the mind, right? But this verse about chanting and listening to the holy name and the qualities of God, that's also a sense organ, right? We listen through our senses, right? We come to the temple, we see beautiful images, we listen to kirtan, right? And it says this text itself says it again and again, in the teachings of Bhakti Yoga, that in this dark age of Kali Yuga, it says that kirtan, or chanting God's name, God's names and glories, is the primary method because of our attachment to the senses. Right, because we cannot, if something is beautiful looking, try not to look. You cannot not look. Right? You know, it's like as a monk, sometime in movies, we're supposed, you know, we have to do like this, right? Because we're not supposed to see everything and everything on modern television or like that, but still, it becomes a little bit like this, you know? It's hard not to look. You cannot, if something is nice, nice to hear, how can we not hear? Something's bad to hear, how can you not hear? Somebody speaking something, how can you not listen, right? The senses are like that. They cannot, it's very hard, especially in this age, to control the senses from something attractive, right? But what if the thing that's attractive is the self, right? Is externalized image of the self. Right? When you look at Ma, what are you looking at? She's ourselves. She's our own consciousness, our own energy, right? When we listen to God's name, it's the sound of the soul, right? God is not different from His name, and God is not different from the soul. Who lives within us, as us, right? So by even though we're seeming to be attracted by music and by kirtan, by the enjoyment, especially some really good kirtan, and go flying, it seems like an incredibly sensual experience, right? But those everywhere the sense goes, senses go, that's only the self, right? Of course, that's true in every situation, actually, right? There's only the self. So only the self alone abides. But we don't see that. Most of our experience of God as this world is the world, not God, you know. So this is a trick. The sages gave us a trick in Kali Yuga, that by kirtan, we seemingly making God an attractive object of the senses, right? We wean ourselves of our attachment to the senses, our addiction to the senses. A trick, right? It's a brilliant trick. Right, it says, by hearing and chanting about the Blessed Lord's qualities. But it's here it says, loke api, even doing regular things. Right, that's the thing. So in everyday life, not just, of course, when we do kirtan, it's one thing. When you're doing japa, you're sitting in meditation. You're supposed to be, you know, if you get a distraction, you bring the mind back. But in everything you do, and actually it says in worldly activities. Of course, that means that whatever our activity is, the mind can be thinking of God's names and glories. Right, Bhagavan Guna, Shravanam Kirtanam, right? Listening and chanting and singing, remembering the divine names and glories of the Lord, of the Divine Mother, even in worldly activities, right? Unbroken. This is very important. Where are we? Number 37, 38. So this is two ways given. One is by the negative description as renouncing objects of enjoyment and renouncing attachment to those objects, and the positive way by hearing and chanting the names and glories of Bhagavan, even during all activities, worldly activities. It says, but mainly, mukhyasta mahat, I need my glasses for this, kripaeva bhagavat kripa lashatpa. But, however, one develops bhakti really by the mercy of great souls, by mahats. Mahat kripaya, by the mercy of great souls. We spent quite a bit last 2 weeks ago on this. By the mercy of devotees, the sadhus, of saints, right? He says the main way. And then if we actually analyze, or not analyze, just honestly look at what started our spiritual life, right? So you almost always, the connection with some devotee, right? Sometimes the connection to a great saint like Ramakrishna and Neem Karoli Baba and Annamayi Ma, we find some saint that inspires it. But even to get to that saint, there's somebody who introduced that saint to us, some devotee, right? And that devotee may not be like Mahat means a great illumined soul, right? But actually all devotees are great in so many ways, right? Because the devotee thinks of God, right? The great saints, what we call, there's a spectrum of people who think of God. We think of God a little bit. The great saints only think of God, right? But that spectrum, continuum. What's the word? I got the wrong word in my mind.
Procession.
Excuse me.
Procession.
Sliding scale. I don't know what it is, but anyway, somewhere along the line, you know, it's like that anybody who thinks of God, what a blessed person that must be. Right, that's also by God's grace, right? So it says that mainly, however, one develops bhakti by the mercy of great souls. It says, or Bhagavat Kripa Alashatva, or by a little bit of God's mercy, right? By the mercy of a saint or a devotee, or by God's, or a little bit of God's mercy. But actually, we know that that's the same thing. God's mercy comes in the form of a devotee. Right, the form of saints, form of sadhus, forms of guru. Right, we quoted a song a couple weeks ago. It's by the mercy of Krishna that one gets guru. By the mercy of guru, one gets Krishna. Right, only by God's grace we meet the devotees and saints and have great souls in our lives. But by their grace, we can remember God, and thus develop our devotion. Mahat Sangasyu Dhulabo Ghamyo Mogascha. Verse 39. The association of great souls is Dhulabha. Dhulabha means very difficult to get. Right? So it's not two things. It's very rare because it's seeming in this age that the devotees are less than in previous age, it's described. But if we're searching, we must go make extra effort to search saints out or devotees out. And it's easier, actually, the devotee company, holy company, is not always easy. Not only, also emotionally not easy, right? Because spiritual life is also quite a struggle. And in the company of devotees, we meet that struggle face to face very often, right? It's also difficult to get, but it says it's also difficult to understand, right? But it's also amogaha, infallible. It has an absolute guaranteed effect. If you keep in the company of devotees, keep in the company of saints, right? The effect is guaranteed. I quoted a verse from Chaitanya Charitamrita, very famous. Saru sangi sarva shastra koya. Lova matra saru sangi sarva siddhi hoya. That saru company of holy company, right? Sarva shastra kaya, all the scriptures declare, right? Lava matra saru sangi, even a fraction of a moment's of holy company, sarva siddhi hoya, gives all attainments, gives all benefit, right? Labhyate pi tat kripaya eva. Company of great souls is obtained. It is obtained only by God's grace. Why is that? The beautiful verse. Tasmims taj jane beda bira bhavat. Because God and his devotees are not different. They're the same. Sri Ramakrishna, we told the story of Sri Ramakrishna's famous vision in front of the Krishna temple, where one old lady was chanting the Bhagavat, right, reciting the Bhagavata, as a called Bhagavat Parayana, recitation of the Bhagavat, in front of the Radhakanta, Shri Radha Radhakanta temple there. And he saw a light come from the deity and go to the scripture. Then he saw that same light go and touch that the woman devotee, that old lady who was chanting. Right? So he saw that this was from his vision, a visionary experience. He says, Bhagavata Bhakta Bhagavan. That God, Bhagavata, Bhakta, the devotee, Bhagavan, the God, the devotee, Bhagavata, and, sorry, I got the order wrong. Bhagavata, the scripture, the Bhagavatam, Bhakta, the devotee, and Bhagavan, the Lord, are the same. And he told his disciples to recite this. Bhagavata Bhakta Bhagavan, Bhagavata Bhakta Bhagavan, as a mantra to remind ourselves that the Lord is not different from his devotee. The Lord acts in the devotee. Right? Also, in poetic description, it's that the God holds the universe within his heart, but the devotee holds God within his heart. Right? So devotee is actually bigger than God. He holds the infinite. Right, seemingly. So that's a very. These are all meant to glorify the position of devotees. Remember this. Therefore, it says Tareva Sadhyatam. Tareva Sadhyatam. This is repeated twice. I mentioned last week in a sutra, by removing any unnecessary syllable, right? It says that Goddess Saraswati becomes ecstatic. Right, the sutra is like it's a form of scripture that's meant to be the bare minimum, the least words to say the most, right? So the purpose is to reduce the words, say it in its most concise way, and something's repeated twice, right? That means it must be really important in a sutra to repeat something twice. Tareva sadhyatam, tareva sadhyatam. Attain this, right? Attain, what is this? Holy company. Right, or it could be strive for this, strive for that. So a brief sum. We went over the last week verses. Now, so it started with a little bit of negative and positive, and now we'll go a little bit the other side. If holy company is so wonderful, right? What could be the negative side or the negative way of approaching the same topic? Right. Dusanga. Sangha means company. Du means bad, wicked, right? We would call it evil company, right? Bad company, right? Evil company, sarva taiva tyajaha. Sarva taiva, should all the time, by all means, right, be tyag, given up, right? You strive for holy company, and at all times, or by all means, right, give up bad company. And so we can be, we have to be careful, because when we start labeling good company and bad company, right? Oh, devotees are good, and non-devotees, they're bad. Right? What's a non-devotee? Well, people who don't have the same devotional focus as we do, or devotional understanding, or the deity, maybe they worship a different deity, or follow a different guru, or a different prophet, or a different book, different revelation, they're bad. We have a different philosophy, right? We shouldn't listen to them. We shouldn't talk to them. We shouldn't be in contact with them, right? And so you can see that has happened, right? But that doesn't seem to be the real, that can't possibly be, not even seem to be, it can't possibly be the real meaning. I've read commentaries and studying these verses that basically state that. This verse shows you should not listen to anybody I read one text, one commentary this morning, actually, that describes, it's interpreting this text from a devotional perspective, which is important. This is a devotional text, right? And it says that to listen to the opposing philosophical school, if this, like, it's weird to think of everything as opposing, but like we believe that devotion's the way. What are people who are teaching that knowledge is the way, right? Or that instead of listening to worshiping God's form, we will say that God doesn't have form. Well, that's wicked company. Should avoid that. Be careful, right? That even listening to such philosophy will confuse you. Right, destroy your devotion, right? And there's not nothing to that, right? In the beginning stages, if we listen to anything and everything, we become confused, right? But this is not a beginning text, right? The Bhakti Sutra is meant for a refined audience of devotees, right? So that's not what's meant by, that can't be what's meant by Dur Sangha, right? So do, we have to understand what do means. Do means evil, means wicked, it means bad, it means dirty, right? So it's not, and it doesn't say people, right? It means anything that pollutes the mind, right? That's do, it should be given up, right? Why? Because if the purpose of devotional practice is to awaken the mind, to purify the mind and heart, the devotion grows. Right. Anything that's doing the opposite would be against our spiritual life, right? And if devotion is your goal, and the feelings of bhakti and keeping God central as the first thought in your mind and heart, the idea of anything getting in the way of changing that could be unbearable, right? And therefore, you'd be very careful. Anything that would take the mind away from God would be very dangerous, right? So it could be people. Right, it could be objects, it could be literature, it could be so many things. It could be what's on TV, you know, whatever, on a certain channel. Right, so not everything is equal. Well, everything's equal, not everything is the same, right? And not everything is the same, not everything is equal, right? How you want to think of it. Right, God, in other words, God has become everything, but by becoming everything, he's become variety. Right, the one has become the world. Dual means that there's good and bad, there's pleasant, unpleasant, there's pure and impure. Well, it's all God, and we can see it that way. That's the goal of life, right? But we can't pretend that it's the same, exactly, right? We have to have some discrimination, right? There's a verse in the Upanishads. There is these Shanti mantras. They call it Shanti mantras because they end with Shanti, Shanti, Shanti. Each mantra, right? Each Upanishad has a sloka, and so many of them start with things like, "May we hear with our ears what is auspicious, may we see with our eyes what is auspicious," right? And like that, right? Because we have, because by what we see, what we take in with all the senses, right, goes to form our mind. Right, I remember one sadhu. He was a very colorful sadhu. His name is, I forget. He may come to me. He's a Vaishnava saint, and he lived many years high in the Himalayas in Gangotri, as a naked sadhu in snow. Right, and he came back after many years of being naked in the snow. He came down, and his parents were still living, And it's been seen, imagine a parent seeing their educated young son, right, with dreadlocks down to his feet, naked in the snow, right? You know, they're crying, right? And so Ananda Maima was present at that time, and she told them, now you're banned the city, you at least wearing one piece of cloth, and now he dresses, right? But, and he also has an inflatable boat, so he has not just a cloth, he has a great boat, and he took me boating on the Ganga one time, so he's sitting there with his, and in it, I remember, the only thing I remember from our boating trip was a very surreal experience. this holy man was, literally, his dreadlocks must have been 15 feet, right? And was an inflatable raft. And he himself rowed. Both, he had two oars, and he did like this. He didn't do like this. He held like this. Very interesting, peculiar person. But he says, the mind is created by what you eat and the company you keep. That was the one thing he told me the whole book, right? Otherwise, he was just a little chit-chatting about the forest we were looking at. But then he says, the mind is created. So it's a good teaching. The mind is made of only two things, the food we eat and the company we keep. Right? So what is the food we eat? The Vedas make a statement that from the purity of food comes purity of mind. Right? It's the same principle, right? But food is not just what we eat. Of course, eating pure food is important. Right, but Shankaracharya interprets this ahara, this what we take in. He interprets this food not just to be what you eat, but what we hear, what we see, right? All what we take in by all the senses is our food, right? And it, like, I've been a vegetarian for, I don't know, almost 30 years probably, right? And so if by accident somebody brings something and I eat something that's not vegetarian, I'll probably get sick, most likely, right? One or two days I'll have diarrhea, vomit, something nauseous, the body will reject it. Right, but in 2 days it's gone. It could be completely out of my system. No major harm done. Right, but if I hear something nasty about somebody, right, 20 years, 50 years later, I won't forget it. Right, or what if I see something on television, on the computer, right, even by accident, right? It's many that may take years to forget it. Right, so what we take in with the other sense is almost more important, and that food's very powerful. So that, again, this is holy company. Avoid impure things that pollute the mind and pollute our consciousness. So God dwells, as I mentioned, God dwells every. And so sometimes the general feeling, sometimes my own reaction when I hear things, I'll be careful of bad company. Right, it's like, well, we're supposed to, I mean, we believe that a goal is to see God in everything and in everyone, right? There's a verse in the Gita that says, Pandita Samadarshanaha, the real wise person is one who sees everything equally, right? Samadarshana, right? Sees everything the same. That is Pandita, right? And so this verse is telling us, be careful. See things differently and be careful what you're dealing with, right? So Sri Ramakrishna also talked about this. He says that while God is in everything and has become everything, right? It's like you could say, well, God's in a tiger also, right? Right? But do you embrace a tiger? The tiger will kill you if you try to embrace it, right? So the tiger God you salute from a distance, right? Certain God you hug, other forms of God you salute from a distance. Right, so he says, so like that was like the devotees you embrace closely, right? But people and things that may harm your spiritual life, that are dangerous spiritual life, you respect, you honor everything, but you honor them from a distance. The way you honor a tiger is to give it its space, right? That's trying to hug it is not honoring it. It's not good for the tiger. It's not good for you, right? So it's a proper respect of that type of person, that type of being, that type of situation is to stay away. That's also a type of worship. That's how you worship God in that form, right? It's not to think, oh, that I'm rejecting God. No, you're honoring God in that form. He told another story of some young, one of the famous stories of Sri Ramakrishna. He says that a young monk, his guru, is given a lecture like this. He says, see everything as God, right? Every being is God only. Right, so he's going for a walk, a japa walk down the street in the marketplace, something, and just then there's an elephant with the mahout, the driver. The elephant has gone mad, become spooked. You can imagine an elephant when it's, and we're talking about the five horses, imagine an elephant, right, how much damage it can do. So it's charging out of control, And the mahout is screaming. The mahout is the elephant driver on top. He's screaming, "Get out of the way, mad elephant! Mad, get out of the way! Get out of the way! Get out of the way!" Right? And but that monk is thinking, "Oh, Guruji said everything is God." Right? So he just sat there looking at the elephant as if it was God. Right? And so as the elephant comes near, the elephant grabs it with his trunk and picks it up and throws it aside. Right? And he falls and breaks himself and becomes unconscious and injured. You can imagine. And the locals send a message to the guru, and all the disciples, all the monks come and bring him back and slowly revive the monk. And then when the guru said, "What happened?" And he says, "Well, the elephant, I saw that the elephant is God, right? And therefore I thought, why should I move?" He says, "But the mahout, he's also God." So the mahout God, the driver God, is telling you, "Get out of the way." Right, that's also God. You have to respect that form of God also. You're not using your intelligence, right? While God's in all beings, God's also in the guru and in the scriptures telling you, be careful with certain types of people. They're not best for your company, certain types of things. God's everywhere, but be careful. Another verse is coming to my mind from early on in the Bhagavatam. We gave this class many, many years ago on this verse of Kapila, sage Kapila, to his mother Devahuti. And he says that we have to see, while God has become everybody and all that, everyone, and we should see everyone's a devotee ultimately. Everyone's not only God, but everyone's a devotee of God in the core of their being, right? But that said, we have to know that God's manifestations are different. And so the proper way to worship the God in all beings is to know how to respectfully deal with him. For instance, if you have a saint, how do you deal with a saint? Right? That person you worship, you serve. A senior person you serve. Right? What about somebody who's at your level of a devotee? Right? Then you befriend. Right, that's so God in a senior person you serve and you obey or listen to, become guide and get guide and blessings from. God in the form of equals, spiritual equals or social equals, like that, you befriend. Right? What about junior person? Then you give guidance and protection. That's also God has come in the form of a newcomer. Somebody just beginning the spiritual, like that, you give protection, you give guidance, right? But what about God in the form of a wicked person, an enemy? Actually uses the term, and somebody's inimical, right? Then you avoid. It says, don't hate. That's not that. There's no such place for, you can't hate God, right? That's not, well, you can, but it doesn't seem to be a good, not the most useful spiritual methodology. Although some great demons who hated God got liberation too. That's another topic. He says you become indifferent, right? That's detached and indifferent. So what other, like the ones, people who are in our immediate world, the senior people we serve, those who are our equals, those we befriend, those who are juniors, those we bless and help and guide and protect, and those inimical, those who are against spiritual life, again, then you just let them be. Let them, we're not fighting them. Right, there's no value in that. Also, just become detached. Asanga. Here it says, "Do not." Actually, sangha means company. It also means attachment, connection. Just be disconnected from them. You don't have to avoid them. Just be disconnected from them. So, evil company should be given up by all means. Why? So, kama, krodha, moha, smriti, bhramsha, buddhi, nasha, sarva, nasha, kara. Karanatvat is the cause, because this bad company, this wicked company, is a cause of something. It's a cause of kama, krodha, moha, smriti, bramsa, buddhi, nasha, sarvanasha. Kama means lust. Krodha means anger. Moha, bewilderment or delusion. Smriti, bramsa means the loss of memory. Sarva nasha means complete ruin, right? Buddhi nasha means loss of a bewilderment of intellect, and sarva nyasa, complete ruin. So this is a summary of another verse in the Gita, right? The where it describes that by what's the verse? By contemplation of the object of desire, one becomes attached. By attachment, what is it? Leads desire. To desire, right? And desire leads to anger. Anger leads to confusion. Confusion to loss of memory. Loss of memory but also ends up with complete ruin. Same. Why is that? In bad company, our desires increase, right? Kama, right? And when desire becomes krodha, anger. Why? Because anger is unfulfilled, the natural emotional reaction to unfulfilled desires. When our desires are frustrated, we get angry. If we analyze every instance of anger is a frustrated desire, even good anger, even righteous indignation. We're angry at people doing wrong, right? We're angry at war and hurting children, right? Because our desire is that people are happy and safe, right? Even a good manifestation of anger is frustrated desire, right? So desire always leads to anger because desires can never be fully fulfilled, right? That's the problem, right? Even if you fulfill desire, it's temporary and will lead to pain ultimately, right? So kama, krodha, moha becomes then when through anger, then we become deluded, we lose our sense of become bewildered, and then we lose our memory, right? We forget what we know. Actually, so many times I analyze my own reactions. And we make mistakes because we're somehow or another, by we become deluded, we forget what we know. We forget our relationships. We forget our own experience in the heat of a moment, right? It was like, we forgot our own experience. Sometimes even our spiritual confusion, we forget our own spiritual experiences. We forget what we've seen, right? Temporarily, we become doubt enters in. So many things on every level, right? This happens. Then buddhi nash, in the mind, then the intellect becomes destroyed, light destroyed. We'll be act irrationally, right? Leading to sarvanyasa, complete, everything is then destroyed, complete ruin, right? So this is the big thing. Why should we avoid bad company? Because in bad company, it causes kama. Evil company is the cause of lust, anger, delusion, forgetfulness, loss of intelligence, and total destruction. Well, that's good to remember. Just put that thing like, godlization or total destruction. It's real simple. Maybe it's not quite as absolute, but it's. But if we analyze it, isn't there's much truth to this, right? So then it says, now it describes the real essence of it in verse 45. It's our last verse of the Narada Sutta for tonight. Tarangita, apime sangat samudravyanti. Tarangita means beginning like a ripple, right? Because we have in our mind, we have all kinds of desires and good and bad things in our mind. These are called samskaras. We have tendencies, vrittis and samskaras. Inherit from our own, from this life and from previous lives also, right? We have different seeds, different things that are vibrating in our consciousness. But there is small ripples, right? But through evil company, this small ripple or wave becomes like an ocean. It expands it like into samudra yanti, becomes quickly as big as an ocean, right? And so we can analyze also because in certain presence, certain samskaras are agitated, are brought up, right? You can see if there's some obvious things. Let's say if you're an alcoholic and you don't drink, right? The presence of alcohol awakens that desire, right? That's an obvious type of thing, right? The object that feeds that vritti, right? So you can see like that. Therefore, Swami Chidananda also said that in that same talk, he says that every corner is a danger for an alcoholic. Because what corner in a real city doesn't have alcohol, right? Some shop, some bar, some restaurant, some store, some, every corner like that. But if you're a teetotaler, you never drank, right? Then it's just another corner, It doesn't awaken. That's not your vritti, not your samskara that's going to be awakened. So by company feeds different vrittis, right? Different samskaras, different seeds. You can think like this. Vritti. Swami Paramahansa Yogananda, I quote this a lot because to me it really hit me when I was a young man. He wrote so many autobiographical yogi, so many beautiful books, right? So poetic and so dramatic in his style. But the one thing I remember out of all those books, I read every one of his books in the early years of early life, is the most unpoetic, but the most uninspirational, but the most helpful. He says that company is stronger than willpower. That was the line that got me, right? Company is stronger than willpower, right? And we in English, we also have sayings like this, and show me who you hang with, and I'll show you who you are. So verses like that, right? Or something like that, a teacher told me once. So therefore, the proper use of willpower is to choose our company carefully, right? To choose the people, the things, the literature, the programming, the environment that feeds and awakens our auspicious, the seeds of devotion, our spiritual qualities, right? Rather than the things that awaken our lust, anger, greed, right? That and slowly takes us away. Because you can see, when I so many devotees, very dear devotees, we've seen that are. There seem to be, for the most part, gone. They're not part of our lives anymore, unfortunately. But somewhere they have devotion. They've seen Ma, they've seen so many things, right? But somehow or another, the most scary thing in spiritual life is having God be the second most important thought rather than the first most important. A devotee, somebody whose God is first. Right, other things are there. We have our different karmas to live in this world. We have to satisfy our destiny in this world. But God is, it's called Paramgati, our real supreme object, aim and object, our goal, Paramgati, our gati. But when God becomes a secondary goal, or the third goal, or the fourth, slowly, still you can, there are pious people and some spiritual understanding like that. But that to me is very dangerous. Right, and I think, from my observation, and also supported by these verses, it's almost always by company, right? Pretty soon you have a different group of friends, right? That God is not the center, most important thing, right? And slowly, then, let's do something different. It couldn't have been nothing necessarily bad, but a little different, right? And slowly the priorities change, because different seeds are being watered. Right, the devotional seeds become a little less, and the other other qualities, other vrittis begin to come up, and slowly the whole personality changes. It's there, right? Nothing's lost in spiritual life. Krishna promised in the Gita that my devotees will never perish. Whatever spiritual progress you've made, you'll take with you. You continue. But what is a fallen yogi? A fallen yogi is someone who a different karma has taken over. Right, so this is an important thing by being careful about our company. We can't. The problem is we can't avoid anybody and everybody. We live in the world, right? We work with certain people. We're not running from the world. We're engaging the modern world. We have to be members of our generation and our own culture, right? Right. But how connected, Sangha is not just company, it's connection. How connected are you to anything and everybody and anything? So I read today a very kind of a funny, Srila Prabhupada, the Hare Krishna founder, he had a very funny story kind of on this point. He says, there's a monkey. There's a monkey, and so an alligator is looking at the monkey on top of the tree, right, and wants to eat the monkey, right? And actually, but he says, "Oh, come, I'll give you a ride on my back," Right, and this is, and the monkey thinks, well, maybe he's offering a nice, this is a nice thing to do, right? I've never been across, you know, the pond like this. I can ride on the back of the alligator. So he comes down, he's a useful thing. He comes on his back, and the alligator comes out. And then the monkey's excited as he's on the back of the alligator. He says, where are we going? Well, I'm going to take you home, right? And then my wife, we're going to take out your heart, and we're going to cook it and eat it. Right? This is a very good. And the monkey is, oh, I'm sorry, I left my heart on the tree. Right? Let's go. You take me back, we'll go back. Right? So he goes, okay. So he goes back. And the monkey jumps on the tree, and the alligator is waiting. And he goes, no, no, I won't. You won't come down. Right? You know, the tree gets out. Right? And Prabhupada's, Srila Prabhupada's commentary of telling the story is that the alligator had the body of the monkey, but not its heart, right? The thing is that's the connection, right? Like we have to live in this world, but who do you really intimately connect with? Who do you give access to your essential being, right? That we have to be careful, right? It's great if we can live only in the company of devotees, awesome. But even that's not easy, and it's not pleasant and not without its dangers, like we all know, right? But even if it was possible and ideal, right? That's great, right? But that's not the situation. We live in a mixed environment, right? With all types of people, all types of things, right? So how do we live in this world? So I want to read the final thing, a few verses, little scene from the Kathamrita, Sri Ram, Gospel of Ramakrishna. When you see, when Sri Ramakrishna says that bhakti as taught by Narada is the way from Kali Yuga, right? He says devotion as taught by Narada. In this instruction, he's giving almost point for point all the points of Narada's given about chanting God's name and glories unceasingly, and about holy company and avoiding bad company. So I read, Master, he asks, how does one draw the mind to God, Sri Ramakrishna? One has to always sing the names and glories of God, right? The first thing. He has it in bold, right? One always should sing God's names and glories, right? Without ceasing, right? What means even, as Narada said, even in daily life, right? In regular life, worldly life, right? And satsang, holy company, right? From time to time, one has to go to God's devotees or sadhus. If the mind stays day and night in the midst of material life, this world of samsara, and in the midst of worldly activities, it will not be drawn to God. From time to time, going into seclusion and thinking of her is very necessary. In the beginning, without seclusion from time to time, keeping the mind on God is very difficult. Right? And it says that our mind, if 24 hours a day we live in holy in worldly environment, with worldly people and worldly conversations, and just in the world, how are we going to think of God? It's almost impossible. It's hard to put the mind on God. So time to time, we have to go into solitude. We have to go two things, he says, to go to find devotees, go to the devotees, right? And go into solitude. Solitude, what's solitude? Solitude doesn't, it's great if we can get it, like that's what retreats are for. Time to time we have to get out of, we have to get a change in environment, the spiritual environment. But there's many ways of going into solitude. He'll describe that. When a young tree is being looked after, it needs to be fenced in on all four sides. Without fencing it, goats and cows will eat it up, right? And that's the thing. In the beginning, it's our spiritual, especially, we have to be protective. A little plant, if you just plant it there, the first goat will come and eat it. A cow will come and eat it. In another place, Ramakrishna said, eventually, when that little seedling becomes a tree, right, goats and cows will take shade under it, right, and not harm it. Right, you can tie an elephant to it. And keep your elephant underneath it to keep it safe. But in the beginning, you have to protect it, right? So therefore, even that verse, I told you that interpretation of the first mantra as don't hear other philosophies and other teachers, right? There's truth to that also. In the beginning stage, you become confused, right? Somebody says one thing and you're trying to, and you're not fixed in your own understanding and you get another idea. That could also, but I'm nervous about that because, well, that the principle is good is not to become confused. But usually, I think that lasts, like people, that fence people leave up for a long time, longer than necessary, right? My Guruji used to tell me, he says, listen to the spiritual spiritual inspiration from all sides, right? And then walk your spiritual path. You listen to everybody, but walk one path, right? That's a better, safer way. But still, this idea of time to time you have to go into solitude. Otherwise, our tender plant in the bhakti scripture is called bhakti lata. Bhakti lata means it's like a creeper. There's the creeper of devotion, a small plant comes, a vine of devotion comes, right? You have to protect it, right, from being destroyed by anything and everything. Meditate, now, what's solitude? Meditate in the mind, in a corner, or in a forest. What are the three? In
Mone, kone, or bone.
Mone, kone, or bone, right? Right, in your own mind, in a corner, in your own shrine room, right? You have to do that. Or in the forest, go on retreat, leave. Time to time, get out of this material environment, right? Or go to seek the company of devotees and just call on to God. And always discriminate between the real and the unreal. God is real, the eternal substance. Everything else is unreal, temporary. Discriminating like this, give up temporary things in the mind. He doesn't say give up temporary things. It's interesting because you just think what's real, what's not, and then whatever is not real, give it up. This is a process of meditation. Where do you put your value? You know it's temporary. That's not your goal. Let it go. Right? Still, you have to live in the world. We can't not live in the world. Right? But where do you have attachment? Humbly. In what way must one live in the material world? Sri Ramakrishna. Do all your work, but keep the mind on God. He says, remember God's name and glories, even in the midst of work. That's Narada Muni just said, right? Same thing. Wife, son, father, mother, live with everyone and serve them, as if they were very much your own people, but know in your mind that none of them are yours. This is a very harsh instruction of Sri Ramakrishna, right? But it's not harsh and not harsh, right? Because he's talking to Master Mahashaya, Mahendranath Gupta, the author, who's a householder, right? And as we know, later, Sri Ramakrishna wanted him, he wanted to become a monk, right? He wasn't that attached to his family. His family caused him a lot of suffering in his life. He was one of those people that family was a really cause of real suffering. And he really wanted to become a monk, right? But Sri Ramakrishna, and many other Sri Ramakrishna disciples were married and became monks. A lot of them were not, but Sri Ramakrishna forbade him. Because he wanted him to be the ideal householder. He wanted to show that his devotees how to live in the world, right? So this is his opening instruction. Live in the world with wife, with children, with boss, with everything, with job, right? But know that they're not yours, right? Treat them as if they were yours, right? But know that really they're also temporary. They're not your ultimate goal. It's so beautiful, but not easy. Right, because that means live with everything without attachment. That's the ultimate, which is again the negative statement at the beginning of our reading, is give up attachment, give up objects. This is the same thing, right? How to live in the world without attachment. And he gives an example. In a rich man's house, a maid is doing all the work, but her mind dwells in her own house in the country. Also, she raises her master's children as if they were her own. She says, my Rama and my Hari. But in her mind, she knows well, none of them are mine. A turtle moves about in the water, but do you know where her mind dwells? It dwells on the riverbank, where her eggs are. Do all actions in the material world, but keep the mind on God. If you enter material life, but haven't attained devotion to God, then you'll get entangled and fall. Danger, grief, suffering, you will be overwhelmed by all of these. And the more you think of the world, the more you will grow attached. You have to smear your hands in oil and then break open the jackfruit. If you don't, then the milky juice will stick to your hands. This is one of Sri Ramakrishna's classic examples also. Jackfruit is very sticky, right? But if you, the technique is you put oil on your hand, then you break it open. Then you can cut and do everything, right? It won't stick. You have to attain the oil in the form of devotion to God and then give your hands to the world's activity. But if you attain this devotion, being in seclusion, but to attain this devotion, being in seclusion is necessary. To bring out butter, you have to go into seclusion and let milk curdle. If you keep disturbing the curd doesn't set. After that, you have to go into seclusion, throw aside all activities, and churn the butter. Then the butter can come out. So sadhana and seclusion. Also, you see, when the mind thinks of God in seclusion, then knowledge, dispassion, devotion are attained. But when you keep it in the world, then that mind sinks down. In the world, there's only thoughts of lust and greed, kamani kanchana. The world is water, and the mind is like milk. If you put it in the water, then milk and water get mixed together and become one. You can't find the pure milk. Having curdled the milk and produced the butter, if you put it in water, it will float. So by first doing spiritual practice in seclusion, you acquire butter in the form of knowledge and devotion. If you keep that butter in the world, it won't mix. It will float. Along with this, discrimination is very necessary. Lust and greed and their objects are temporary. God is the only substance. What is there in money? There is rice, there is dal, there is clothing, there is a place to live, up to this. But the Lord, Bhagavan, is not attained by it. So money cannot be the purpose of life. This is called discrimination. Understand? Yes, sir. I'm skipping a little bit. M asks, can one have a vision of God? Sri Ramakrishna. Yes, certainly one can. From time to time, staying in seclusion, singing her names and glories, discrimination. You have to rely on all these methods. M. In what state does one have her vision? Sri Ramakrishna. When you weep with intense yearning, she can be seen. People weep a bucket of tears for family. People weep a flood of tears for money. But who is weeping for God? You have to call out with a real cry. Saying this, Thakur, Sri Ramakrishna, began a song. Call out, O mind, with a real cry, and how can Mother Shama stay away? How can Shama stay away? How can Kali stay away? If you are earnest, O mind, then take hibiscus flowers and bell leaves, and dipping them in the sandal paste of devotion, offer them at Mother's feet. As soon as there is yearning, the dawn sky has become red. After that, the sun will show himself. After yearning is the vision of God. If three attractions are combined, then she shows herself. A worldly man's attraction to the world, a mother to her child, and a devoted wife to her husband. If these three attractions are put together, then by the force of that attraction, God can be attained. The point is this, you have to love God, like a mother loves her son, like a devoted wife loves her husband, like a worldly man loves the world. These three people's love, these three attractions, when you've combined them as much as you can and give it to God, you attain her vision. You need to cry to her with yearning. A kitten knows only how to call out mew, mew. Meow, meow, I guess, right? I guess an American kitten go meow. And Bengali kittens go mew. Wherever the mother puts it, there it stays. Sometimes she puts it in the kitchen, sometimes on the ground or in the bed. When it is in trouble, it only calls out, mew, mew. It doesn't know anything else. Wherever the mother may be, as soon as she hears the sound of mew, mew, she drops everything and comes. Hari Om Tat Sat. Thank you for your kind attention. Any questions or comments? Hopefully not. I mean, everybody is fully convinced. Excellent. Everyone's fully convinced. I'm so good at this. Jai Ma, Jai Ma.